I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly biotechnology podcast that's not just about biotechnology. Providing information to help you change hearts and minds. Moving innovations to application with communication.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things it can do for people and a planet. And today we're going to talk about the new book called Seeds of Science. And we're lucky to have the author with us today, Mark Linus. Hi, Mark.
Hi there, Kevin.
Yeah, so I know it's early, and we're actually recording this on the launch date for this particular book, but still it's been out, and people have been discussing, and what I'd really like to focus on are what are some of the provocative punchlines that would really encourage our listenership to start to explore it more and really understand your experience and your point of view, because I think it's really unique. So thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure thing. Well, I mean, for me, the whole experience has been somewhat cathartic, as you might imagine. It was a long time ago that I was a sort of full-blown anti-GMO activist. I mean, I was in my very early 20s, so I look back on my younger self as somewhat naive, as you are when you're young in many cases. But it was also quite a life-changing experience. I mean, it was the closest I ever came to really feeling like I've helped change the world to some extent. Even if looking back, it wasn't changing it in a positive direction. But we did, you know, we decontaminated all of the GM crop sites that there were in the UK at the time in the mid to late 90s, more or less stopped the whole direction of scientific research and innovation on genetic engineering. So all of the other food crops, you know, there's no GMO wheat, there's no barely any potato, there's no GMO rice, basically, and all of that. I think because there were so many products ready to go, more or less, that really came down to this whole movement, which I was involved in the early stages of.
And back then, you really felt you were doing the right thing, right? I mean, you and your friends were, as you say, saving the world.
Yeah, I mean, everyone does, you know, that you don't make that kind of commitment lightly. And it was a very strong moral commitment that I had and that we all had, and that I think most anti-GMO activists to this day still have. There's a lot of, it's always, you know, you're always, when you're on the other side from somebody, you want to say they're motivated by money or they're motivated by greed or, you know, ascribe them some ill intent. But I think for the most part, anti-GMO people are doing what they're doing because they believe it's the right thing to do. Certainly that was the case back when I was involved in the movement. It's, you know, no one was in it for the money. There wasn't any money. We were just grassroots activists. But the issue, of course, really is whether it was the right thing to do. And obviously, I've concluded that it was not. But there's that, you know, what the process was in terms of my own change of mind and change of heart, and you know how that sort of intersects with science and values and stuff like that is the story I tried to tell in the book.
And that really is a huge part of your story, is that process of changing your mind and maybe having the courage to change your mind. And I think it ties in with what you were just discussing, that when you're on the side of anti-GMO or against technology or against this concept, that a lot of people aren't necessarily really against a technology. It's more the purveyors of that technology and the major folks who profit from it. And so how did that play into your story? And then how hard was that to change your mind? Because were you actually feeling like you might be supporting these other efforts that you fundamentally may oppose?
Well, to go back to the first point of your question, whether it's the purveyors of the technology or the technology itself, actually, I disagree with you. I think there was inherent aspects of the technology itself which meant that we opposed it. And it wouldn't really have mattered, and in fact, it hasn't mattered if it's being done by, you know, a village cooperative or a big multinational company. If it's done by a big multinational agrochemical company, then sure, it's easier to demonize and to oppose, and you've got more reasons for doing so potentially. But we were against the whole march of sort of human intrusion into life itself, which is represented, or we felt was represented, by genetic engineering. You know, the increase in human power and agency over the natural environment, which is represented by directly being able to change genes and alter genomes. So I think you need to get that point. Partly there's the sort of the very basic yuck factor, which you can see coming out in all of the various myths about, I don't know, scorpion genes in strawberries or whatever it happens to be. But those are playing off on a more intuitive moral revulsion that so many people have about this idea of crossing species barrier, about moving genes, and more basically about, you know, tampering with nature. You'll see a lot of the objections are, you know, ideas about, yes, but, you know, humans have got technology wrong in the past, and people will cite, you know, failures like thalidomide and, and DDT, things like that, as a reason for, you know, as a reason for not doing something, or a reason to oppose an innovation. But that's not, you know, they're not opposing it because things have gone wrong in the past. There's something about that technology which they feel revolted by and which they have a moral objection to. And I think it is important to get that point.
That's a fair point. So how were you able to overcome that? And what was it that about the evidence that swayed you to revise your thinking on the topic?
Well, it sort of comes down to a kind of cost benefit, really. I haven't completely overcome it. I mean, in an odd sort of way, I don't think you can entirely shake off these things. I mean, the scientist in me would not have a problem with eating scorpion genes in a strawberry because, you know, it's just a few base pairs of DNA. I mean, who cares, right? But it's difficult to shake off the moral revulsion. I mean, there's different ways, actually, interestingly, how this is played out. You know, there's experiments that have been done, you know, saying, right, I've got a cockroach and it's completely sterile and I'm juicing it and adding to some orange juice. Would you have that? You know, people just go, no way. Or even like chocolate, which is shaped like a, you know, dog turd. But you know it's chocolate, but you still don't really want to eat it, you know? So I think this kind of stuff you can't let go of. And on a more serious level, I'm not in favor of genetically engineering things willy-nilly. And I make that point in the book. A lot less keen on genetic engineering natural species. I'm not particularly bothered about our cultivars, you know, all of the various human, well, crop plants that you find in farmers' fields, because they're already largely human creations. They bear very little resemblance to their wild ancestors, and they're generally not very competitive in the environment, so they don't go anywhere outside the fields. In fact, they need a lot of tending to even survive in the fields. So I'm not worried about farmers using GMOs. I'm not so keen on some of the projects that are out there to genetically engineer, you know, wild trees or corals or things like that. So I'm not completely starry-eyed about genetic engineering to this day, but I think it's obviously an important tool. Certainly it's safe in terms of the food supply and all of that stuff. There's a scientific consensus about that, and I think it's one of the options which needs to be considered, but you do also need to consider people's moral objections. And, you know, if you do that openly, you can say, okay, you have a moral objection to having a bacterial gene in maize, corn, but do you also have a moral objection to people, you know, dying of starvation? And do you need to somehow trade off on those two things? Perhaps you need to overcome one moral objection in order to address the other. So at least then we're talking about realities rather than having sort of pseudoscientific debates about things that just aren't real.
It's a very important point, because what it does is it explains that there is a continuum of ways to think about this. And yesterday morning I was speaking with high school teachers, and one of them said, well, what are the ethics of tinkering with DNA? And I said, you know, because I come from far on the other side of this, just with the way I think of this as a scientist, by saying, what are the ethics of not doing it? When you have an opportunity to solve a problem like for hunger or malnutrition or plant disease, and you have the tools but refuse to use them, you know, isn't there something there as well? And I think that when all of us who are in this ball game of discussing and thinking about this really start to accept that others have opinions and feelings based upon their experiences that place them not in one camp or the other, but somewhere along this rather sophisticated continuum, I think it really makes it easier for us to have meaningful conversations.
That's true. And it would be nice to be in a place where we're not accusing others who disagree with us of, well, not only having ulterior motives, but being motivated by emotionality or intuition. And so I think there tends to be a false dichotomy between this idea that some people think like scientists and they're empirically driven, and whereas the kind of lump and mass out there are just motivated by emotions and they don't understand anything. So I do kind of reject that deficit model in the book. I think all of us, including scientists, are entirely motivated by emotions. And we tend to select the evidence to support our sort of tribally motivated conclusions. So there's a much broader debate about that. And it's important not to be naive, really, about some of these kinds of supposedly scientific debates, because most of the time science is used as a ball that gets batted backwards and forwards from one side to another, but it's not really what's going on.
No, exactly. And that's really one of the things that I've learned over the last, 5 or 6 years that really made me more, I think, effective in discussing this was, a lot of that same kind of idea. And when you were really starting to crack the door, feeling that maybe there was a change brewing in terms of your interpretation of this technology, what was it that was really motivating that shift and changing your mind?
Well, you used the word courageous, describing my change of heart. But actually, I don't think it was particularly courageous, and I'm not being false humility here. It's just that I consciously resisted making that decision for a really long time. So I first began to have doubts, or I had doubts pointed out to me I think it was 2008. There was many years that, I mean, I resisted that and I tried to find evidence to go against it. And I really didn't want to have to make the kind of sacrifice in terms of my sort of social network and everything else that I knew would be, come by changing my mind. But, ultimately, I had to make a difficult choice between being true to my sort of friends and colleagues in the scientific community and true to my reputation as a science communicator, albeit on climate change largely up to that point. But, I wanted to be somebody who was seen to get the science right. I cared about my reputation. And that ultimately outweighed the need to stay true to the sort of central ideologies of the environmental movement. But that's because I'd sort of left the environmental movement as an activist and campaigner and become more of somebody who was, working with as a science communicator primarily. So I was by that point in a safer place to come out and speak in public. You've had a tougher time than I have. And it wasn't because you changed your mind. It was because you became publicly identified with this issue. So there's many ways really that you can that you can have a tough time in some of these very polarized debates.
Yeah, I think that it's in your case a little bit different in that there's a certain kind of inertia to changing one's mind. And we talked about this in Talking Biotech number 1 3 years ago, is what is it that finally allows you to step away from a given line of thinking into something that seems at least very opposed to what you were thinking? And what was interesting about your case from the book was the people who were there to help you after you came out with the change, or the discussion with the change of heart, that Nina Fedorov, Mark Van Montague, other folks were those who were able to give you some other support and advice. And could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that was very helpful. I mean, at the hardest point after I made this speech about having changed my mind in 2013, getting an email from Fedorov saying, just saying, look, you're in a tough place, stick with it. Here's what we scientists would like to hear you saying and would like to do to support you. So I felt almost privileged to be given the opportunity to do that job. But I was also aware that I didn't want to irrevocably lose friendships. And there's places later on in the book where I actually go back and speak to some of my oldest friends, people who I was involved in the anti-GMO campaign with, and see where they're at, and try my best to give them a fair hearing. Because in earlier drafts of the book, it was a bit more polemical, and I was sort of really sounding off and just, well, you know, it wasn't quite a rant, but I mean, there was sort of, there was anger there. And I think I've hopefully let go of that a bit. And because I don't think any of us learn by misunderstanding what our opponents are thinking and doing. And I don't think you can make any progress if you imagine that people who oppose you are motivated by, you know, evil deeds of some sort. So I there's quite lengthy passages where I go back and speak to, you know, Jim Thomas, who was at Greenpeace initially, and now at the ETC group, and George Monbiot, you know, the environmental writer who's been a very long term friend of mine, and Paul Kingsnorth, who's a sort of has been a sort of dark ecologist, if you like, and see where they are and try and really understand, because I think it's important for readers, particularly those who are sort of on the pro science side of these arguments, to really get where opponents are coming from.
And couldn't agree more. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back on the other side. We're discussing the book Seeds of Science with the author Mark Linus, and we'll be back with the Talking Biotech podcast right after this.
Hi, Talking Biotechers. Episode 140 is important in that it emphasizes the importance of critically analyzing something very important, our own opinions. We form opinions and thoughts from the evidence we deem credible. Sadly, that tends to be the evidence that's already accepted from people we relate to, the folks in our trusted communities. You sometimes hear social scientists think of them as tribes. But in episode 140, I talked to Mark Linus about his new book, Seeds of Science. Now, Mark was not certain about technology to the point where he participated in actively stopping it. To his credit, he stepped back, looked at the data, and changed his mind. The good news is that he sees technology with great nuance. He's no fan of companies and not even the rabid tech supporters, but he's a fan of technology that can help people or a planet. And this is the challenge to you. Listen to the podcast and challenge what you believe. Ask yourself honestly, what would it take to change my mind? And if confronted with that evidence, would I have the courage to change it? We live in strange times. I mean, the good news is that the way forward is easy. It's the truth. We need to test ourselves, challenge others, share beautiful stories, read Seeds of Science, critically evaluate Linus's claims, and share your thoughts on his thinking. The bottom line is that we have to constantly test ourselves for self-delusion and ensure that we are objectively thinking about data. Don't be anti-GMO, pro-GMO, be pro-science. Get excited about rigorous tests of claims and share that information. And read Mark's book, and for what it's worth, I bought mine online and I'm not being paid off by Big Linus. I just thought that I appreciated his sophisticated discussion of a topic that is immediately polarizing and polluted by mistrust. If we can talk to each other and, well, talk to ourselves about challenging our beliefs, maybe that's the best way to have a productive discussion and get this technology out to those who can benefit from it.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast today discussing the new book, Seeds of Science, with author Mark Linus. And Mark, we were discussing before about the time of change and some of the things that happens when you create change, the relationships that become strained. But later in the book, you also talk about the idea of the movement itself and anti-GMO. You know, what are some of the things that it did well, and what are some of its aspects that were consistent with environmentalism? What can we say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I struggled with that initially because I didn't really want to write a chapter about what the opposition got right, which is, I think, how I titled it. But I wanted to try to understand really why there might be objections to technologies and why these might be both relevant and important objections to have aired. Because there are limits to how far you would want humans to intrude in DNA of natural species and so on. And, you know, there needs to be an honest debate about what those limits might be. And a debate also about the trade-offs, like you said earlier. If you don't genetically engineer rice to express beta-carotene, then you have deprived yourself of a tool potentially of dealing with vitamin A deficiency in children in poorer countries. Maybe that's a sacrifice you wish to make because you're against the use of this technology for various other reasons. But again, let's have this open and let's have this explicit. I also, can't remember whether it's that chapter, but I was also quite critical, really, looking historically at how Monsanto handled the initial rollout with their choice of Roundup Ready as the first trait, because I think that's indelibly linked GMOs with pesticides, and of course you've got the whole glyphosate debate, which has really erupted in the activist scene in the last couple of years, and so that's been a way really for the anti-GMO crowd to firmly keep this idea, this meme going that GMOs equals pesticides, pesticides equals GMOs. It's all about big chemicals companies selling more pesticides, and which is something that is still very widely believed and out there amongst the general public. And I think that really does come down to Monsanto's decision back in 1996 to lead with Roundup Ready rather than BT, because if it had been BT, then you'd have had insect resistant crops, and they could have said, look, this is reducing insecticide sprays by farmers, isn't that worth having? Whereas Roundup Ready had not only did it have no benefits for consumers that they could perceive, but it made people think, my cornflakes are being sprayed with weed killers, and it's all being done to benefit this company that used to make Agent Orange. So, you could see why it was an absolute open goal for activists to kick the ball through.
And quite to the flip side of that, the same BT technology has now been implemented very well in the brinjal or the eggplant in places like Bangladesh. That's also covered in your book. But could you cover a little bit about that and how do you see that as a step forward in the way that this technology may be eventually more acceptable?
Well, I mean, if you wind the clock back a little bit more and look at how BT cotton was deployed in India, the environmental activists managed to link that with pesticide increases, even though this trait of insect resistance, it was there, and basically its only value was so that farmers could spray less insecticide. And yet Vandana Shiva and her ilk managed to sow this narrative, really establish this narrative of farmers being now hooked on pesticides, they're swallowing pesticide, they've got to spend more money on pesticides, which is the precise opposite of what was actually happening in the field. And so I was aware, because I was involved with Cornell and USAID at the early stages of the BT brinjal being offered to Bangladeshi farmers, that this was a really important sort of test case, or at least an opportunity to not get the communications wrong again and not let the antis run away with the narrative. So we did spend a lot of time in the field with farmers trying to get their perspectives out and trying to get the story out that this was a way to reduce farmers spraying pesticides and how that was potentially important both for farmers' health, for their bottom line, and for the environment.
And you also talk about other possibilities in the African continent, and it's a significant portion, at least of one chapter, and really talk about some of the potential benefits there and the politics. And really what the thing that was really disturbing was the degree of activism on the ground from something like ActionAid that in places like Uganda are actively stopping technology developed by Ugandans from reaching Ugandan farmers. And can you tell us a little bit about that type of activism that's or maybe coming from the EU and USA to influence decisions in the African continent?
Well, when you put it like that, of course, it sounds terrible. I mean, you think, well, why would ActionAid be trying to deprive African farmers of better seeds that could improve their livelihoods? But, of course, they don't see it that way. And so you've got a collision of not just perspectives on this issue, but of entire worldviews, really. You know, do you have a sort of techno-optimist vision that subsistence African farmers could benefit from innovations, particularly those that have been developed abroad, whether they're genetic or anything else, really? Or do you have a worldview that African farmers need to be protected from rapacious, money-grabbing foreigners, who are trying to impose some kind of new colonialism, whether it's capitalist or something else, whether it's multinational companies coming in there? And there's all that suspicion, if genetic engineering is happening, then Monsanto will be coming in. They'll be stealing farmers' seeds and patenting them, and farmers will be deprived of their livelihoods thereby. And that's what ActionAid and all of the NGOs believe. You know, they believe that agroecology and seed saving and small scale, more traditional farming is the answer for these African farmers, which is just as much an outside perspective, by and large, actually. I mean, it's not like the idea of organic farming was originated in Africa. So you've got, in some ways, you've got these competing foreign narratives battling it out, really, to see which one wins in Africa. And again, I wanted to try to do justice to that debate. I'm quite clearly on one side of it now, but I was on the other side before. And try to understand and to hear really how the debate plays out with Africans doing most of the talking. So that's really how I tried to write that chapter.
Because it is really intriguing. I always come to the table with these things thinking, well, maybe everyone's both right, and that there are technology applications that could serve people very well, and we should be sensitive to the ideas of colonial pasts and infringement upon the rights of folks in other sovereign nations, especially the poor. And I learn a lot of this from you. I mean, I learn a lot from you, listening to you, and it become very sensitive to that. And this is where this whole discussion has to have much more nuance than we're getting. And if we were to really look at how this is working going forward, and you know, in your last chapter, 20 years of failure, you know, how does it tie in with the way that maybe the anti-movement can tailor its thinking, and maybe the folks who are on the side of technology, what can we do a little bit better to make the communication on this a little less polarized?
Well, I think that's the challenge, really. And I come to this as somebody who's spent, a decade campaigning on climate change, which became extremely polarized, politically polarized, particularly in the United States, to the extent that it's become a problem which is almost impossible to solve, or at least to solve through conventional democratic political means. And that's, you know, that's not just a huge shame. It also means that we can't save the planet as effectively as we might have done had we not seen such deep polarization. And, you know, fortunately on the GMO issue, it's not as politically polarized. It hasn't just got caught up in the culture wars in the US as much. But there's elements of that there. I mean, like I found, you know, the reviews of Seeds of Science have been much more positive in the right-wing media. The Wall Street Journal piece I had in recently, most of the correspondence was, you know, we agree with you on GMOs, but why are you still pushing this failed climate change narrative? You know, so just the flip side of what I was campaigning against before, and it's quite depressing that people really can only have one or the other perspective. There's no, you know, nobody seems to be able to have let's look at the science on this, and maybe that's just the world we're living in. But I think it's those of us who, you know, are across these different areas and do our best to try to understand the science, what the state of the science is on both climate change and genetic engineering and some of these other controversies, need to get out there and communicate it, because there's a lot of people out there who are ideologically very determined and don't have really much interest in what the scientists are actually saying and what the facts are of the issue.
And I guess that really ties in with the really last question is, if this is a question where the science looks really good on, say, climate and GE crops, what do we do as people who are either scientists or folks who are science enthusiasts or people who really see the value in technology of making a difference for people and a planet? What can we do better?
Well, I think we have to bring other people around to our worldview, which is, in my mind, it's a progressive worldview. It's I consider myself a supporter of humanitarian, democratic values, both with a capital and a small D, by the way. I believe in power to the people. I don't believe in, well, either corporate control or in autocracy. I'm extremely concerned about, the apparent backsliding of democracy in many parts of the world. And I see this as part of a wider struggle that we're all engaged in. I mean, it's no surprise that the Russians have been pushing anti-GMO stuff so strongly on the internet, because they're trying to undermine trust and to corrode people's trust in institutions, if you like, or at least in democratic institutions. So I don't know. I see this as a broader defense of Enlightenment values, really, of which, you know, belief in the scientific method and is a part, but also belief in progress, the idea that we can solve problems using human ingenuity and technology, and that we can make the world a better place. That, you know, too many people these days are just going with conspiracy theories and imagining that there's somebody out there to get you, and that everyone's evil, and that, you know, they don't see enough good in the world. And so, yeah, I'm a progressive, and that's what I'm fighting for. And ultimately, I think science is one of the best tools we've got, and we shouldn't ignore it.
And one of the places where you've had a lot of impacts, Mark, was with Alliance for Science and what's happening at Cornell. And can you tell us a little bit more about that program?
Yeah, so we started the Cornell Alliance for Science in 2014, so fairly early on, with some kind support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And for me, it's just been such a inspiring, transformative experience, really, to work with such a high caliber academic institution, primarily in developing countries. And a lot of it's been training work, really. Working with communicators and people who are defending science in Africa and Asia and elsewhere. One of the things we did in the last couple of years was work on the March for Science and get March for Science rallies going, in Uganda and in Nigeria and all sorts of places where they weren't previously being held. So, because, you know, science is a global value, and I think that's such an important thing. And so I'd encourage anyone who wants to be a science ally and to join that movement to go on the website at Cornell Alliance for Science and join up. There's so much we can do, and if we work together, we can change the world for the better.
Very good. And if people wanted to learn more about you or follow you on social media, where would they do that?
Well, I'm quite Twittery, so I'm Mark_Linus is my Twitter handle, and other than that, give the book a shot. See if you can get through it without being sent to sleep.
A great endorsement, right?
No, yeah,
thank,
right.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today on the Talking Biotech Podcast, and hope to see you pretty soon at a conference somewhere.
Okay, thanks, Kevin.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Write a review on iTunes. Or don't. No, it really helps us because they look really good, and I think we have almost all 5 stars except for one person who gave us 3 for some reason. But definitely, I think it helps people when they're making their tough decisions between different scientific podcasts, which ones they want to follow. And so it's really helpful to have more good reviews. Actually, our numbers in this podcast have gone down a little, and I don't think it's because of the guests or the hosts, maybe it is, but I think it has gone down simply because there's more content to choose from and more excellent quality podcasts that are out there, especially in the area of science. So your reviews really do matter. Thank you very much for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.